Welcome to Blunt Dissection, the original and longest-running long-form interview show in veterinary medicine, where we delve into the minds of the creme de la creme of our profession and beyond. I'm your host, Dr. Dave Nicol. On each episode, I have the privilege of dissecting the success stories of world-class talent, those who have scaled the heights of achievement and are shaping the future of our field. Together, we'll explore their stories, their life-changing decisions, thought patterns, processes, habits, anything that enable them to operate at the very top of their game. Our goal? To give you the insights, the inspiration, the aha moments that you can use to carve your own pathway to success in this incredible field we call veterinary medicine. Because remember, everyone, you included, has a story. So sit back, take notes if you wish, and let's get ready to dissect success on another episode of the Blunt Dissection Podcast. Okay, so welcome to another episode of Blunt Dissection. This is the third in our Changemakers series, and the point of these Changemaker series is to highlight something that is a big picture issue in veterinary medicine that if we don't pay attention to, this is the sort of thing that could bite us on the bum, or indeed the sort of thing that if we miss it, it might be an opportunity that we miss that never spools back around. So to shine a spotlight on areas you might not otherwise be thinking of. So on the show today, I have Dr. Jeremy Watson. Now, Jeremy graduated from University of Melbourne in vet science. That is Melbourne in Australia. Australian mate, g'day, and all of that. Graduated with honours back in 1998. That was the year I graduated, Jeremy. Established the Brimbank Vet Clinic in Melbourne. And then in 2011, way before most of us were even really thinking about this stuff over our cornflakes in the morning, rebuilt his practice, incorporating a lot of the latest, at the time, environmental design features. He's pretty handy with not just the rebuilding and the old, or the new, subject of sustainability. He's pretty damn handy with a scalpel as well, and got his memberships in the Australian and New Zealand College of Veterinary Science in Small Animal Surgery. For those in America listening, that is a level, how do you describe that, Jeremy? It's sort of a between sort of boarded and certainly above general practitioner, showing that you've dedicated yourself to a level of proficiency and been accredited by your peers as such. So it's a good qualification to have, and a handyman with a scalpel. In 2020, he joined Vets for Climate Action, which is an action group which has members globally and is concerned specifically with human impacts on climate change and how we can work in veterinary medicine to make our sector more sustainable, or really get to actually net zero. And in 2021, and this is cool, I really like this, Brimbank Vet Clinic became the first vet clinic in Australia to be registered as carbon neutral on the Australian government's Climate Active Register. He is the chair of the Vets for Climate Action Climate Care Program Advisory Committee. He has completed further training 2021-2022 at University of Cambridge on sustainability subjects, and most recently and most excitingly, and the reason we're having this conversation today, is in November last year, published a paper in Frontiers in Veterinary Science called The Path to Net Zero Carbon Emissions for Veterinary Practice. So, Jeremy, what a little resume there. Very impressive. Super excited to have you on the show. So welcome to Blunt Dissection.
Thanks very much for that comprehensive introduction. Look, very pleased, honoured, excited to be here tonight here and this morning where you are, but pleased to participate in this discussion tonight.
Right. So I'm going to get straight to it. And it's great to hear an Australian accent for the first thing. It's been a wee while since we've had one on the show. Australia, in some ways, has been a second home for me. And one of my impressions whilst I was there was it was very much on the front line of climate change or climate science for two reasons. Reason one, it is a very hot country, which is seeing very visually some of the extremes of climate change happening. think the devastating bushfires, the incredible droughts that are happening. And I know these things are not new to Australia, but they're perhaps more extreme and more frequent events. Flipping over to the incredible flooding and the devastation the flooding has then caused, these are kind of unprecedented. So on one hand, you've got Australia being on the front line of feeling the impact of climate change. On the other hand, my impression was always, and I hope that's changed, that it was governed by groups that were very anti-climate science and almost denialists in some of the politics that I was seeing across in Australia. So I am thrilled there's an Australian that's leading this and publishing on this. Can you give me your sort of take on that, you know, from the Australian point of view?
Yeah, well, I guess there's a lot to unpack there, I guess. But then that's part of my motivation as to why I've got to where I am today, is that I've always been interested in sustainability, and the whole climate science and global warming issue has always made sense to me. You know, as vets, we're scientists. We understand equilibrium situations, which I guess what it is, it's a giant equilibrium between the atmosphere and the carbon dioxide levels, and the carbon dioxide moving from the soil to the air and to the water and cycling around. And the trouble is that we're putting too much into the air, and that's upsetting the balance of everything, really. So that always seemed quite obvious to me. But what intrigued me is why other people didn't see it this way and were keen to get things, get acting and deal with the problem. And I've always, I guess, been interested in the political side of things, and I've gotten very frustrated through the last 10 years or prior, perhaps the 2010 to 2020 period, when we had conservative governments, or mostly conservative governments in Australia, who were actively denying the process or simply impeding any progress on dealing with the issue. And so after each electoral cycle, you know, you get more and more frustrated, depressed, gutted, whatever you want to call it. And so I thought, well, there's no point in just repeating this all the time. It's time to try and get involved with some other people, collaborate, and try and establish some influence within my own sphere of influence. And it kind of came at a time in my life. I guess all my planets have kind of lined up at once, because I'm nearing the end of my career. I've always been interested in sustainability and doing something on climate change. And my kids are grown up, so I've got more time, and I've wanted to push into a new area. And then along came Vets for Climate Action, and I connected up with a group of other people who are like-minded, and I thought, ah, okay, this is where I want to be. Let's see how far we can push this. And there's a really, you know, if you're back on Australians, I don't know whether you remember Tom Hungerford. He was the head of Sydney University, and he set up continuing education in Australia, probably back in the late 70s, early 80s. And he always used to talk about the Goanna track to success. And what he was talking about is, and I suppose for people who are non-Australian, a Goanna is like a big lizard, but the Goanna climbs up a tree. And the analogy is, you find something interested, you start climbing up the tree and exploring all the branches, and eventually you get to the top and have a look at the view. If you don't like it, you climb down, find another tree. But it's a way of perhaps becoming an expert in one niche or something that you're particularly interested in, if you can continue to follow your passion. So I guess I'm embarking on that path at the moment.
God, every fiber in my body wants to dive off into that more and talk about learning and development, but that's not the subject for today's conversation. So I'm going to fight that tooth and nail, though I think it is a wonderful analogy. I love pictures. I love analogy. It's just a terrific one. Okay. And we'll get into, I want to hear a bit more about your backstory and how you got to this point and the journey you went on in your practice. And I wonder if we might weave those two things together as we walk through one of the central pillars of the study or the paper you've just published. But what's interesting is, I was reading through your resume, you were the first veterinary practice to be entered onto the register of the carbon neutral register in Australia. Were you the only? How many are on there since?
Still the only one, but there's one about to be registered. Another, in fact, the chair of the Vets for Climate Action has put her practice through the process, so she's another one. I've since found a couple of other practices who've done their own sort of carbon neutral audit, one as early as about 2002, I believe, and they've just gone ahead and done a whole lot of stuff themselves, but they haven't bothered to get on a formal register. So there's lots of people out there having a crack at it in different ways, but I guess the main reason I did is I wanted to find out you know, what it was about. So we built our new practice in 2011. Great place to work, lots of natural light, naturally warm, naturally cool. We had special heat exchange ventilation, so we didn't lose energy, but we kept the fresh air all the time, so it didn't smell like a vet clinic. Lots of benefits. And then we started putting solar panels on and more solar panels. And then we filled the whole roof up with solar panels and became a net producer of electricity. And I thought, well, you know, we must be carbon neutral. But once I thought, oh, well, maybe I'll explore this a little bit further, and through some contacts found an auditor and got them to actually guide us through the whole process. And I discovered that there's actually, you know, a whole lot more to it than just having all your power from solar panels. And so really, I guess the main reason I did it was a fact-finding mission, because no one else seemed to have done it in a comprehensive manner, and to find out what's involved and what are the components of the carbon footprint of a vet practice.
That's an interesting place to dig into. I'm immediately curious about what you learned and what surprises turned up for you there. My mind goes to anesthetic gases right away as being one of the more obvious things that might be an issue for us. But what did you learn that, and perhaps some of those things were things you might have been suspicious of, but things that really took you by surprise in that? And what's the process of that audit trail?
Yeah, so maybe if I just give everyone a little bit of a background. So your emissions in a practice are divided up into three groups. Now, scope one, which is emissions produced on the practice, like burning gas for your heating or isoflurane anesthetic gases being exhausted into the atmosphere. So they're things you have control over. Then your scope two is your power supply. So buying your power from the grid, depending on where you are, it will have more or less emissions. So some areas have a lot of hydro, so it's low emissions electricity, but other areas have a lot of coal, and so it's much higher. And then the scope three emissions, and this is where all the challenge is going to be, I think, is all the other things that associated with your business that generate emissions. And so things like employee commute, going to conferences, pets cremation, waste to landfill. And then ultimately the big challenge will be medical consumables. And so they're the kind of three sort of broad groups. And so the surprising ones, well, certainly before I went into the audit, isoflurane was a real eye-opener for me, because I didn't realize that that was a greenhouse gas, but this is going back a few years.
Sorry to interrupt, but how does that stack up in regard, like with carbon and methane? We hear a lot about methane being a much worse greenhouse gas or more powerful in its effects than carbon. Where does isoflurane sit on that scale?
So they use the concept of global warming potential to rate different gases. And so carbon dioxide is one, methane's about maybe 30, isoflurane is about 500, 550. And then you get desflurane, which is up in the thousands, and nitrous oxide, which is maybe a little lower, but lasts 100 years in the atmosphere. So all of these gases have, you know, quite significant aspects. And so, you know, for example, the anesthetic gas emitted from, say, a 20 kilogram dog for an hour or so, this might be equivalent of driving a car, say, 30 or 40 kilometers, you know. So there's a really good app you can download from Yale University called Gassing Greener, and then you can plug in all the parameters of your anesthetic and compare different ones. So you can compare an isoflurane anesthetic as opposed to an intravenous anesthetic, and you just see that there's just no comparison.
What was the place? So the Gassing Greener is the name of the app. Who produced the app?
Yeah, Yale University in the US.
Yale.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. Right. And immediately that was the thought was, you know, total intravenous or some other form of anesthesia where they're on oxygen and other is a way to go. All right. So we could dive into nerdy detail stuff there, but I want to keep it sort of so we get through the actual nature of the process. Were there other things that jumped out to you beyond the anesthetic gas as you were going through your audit?
Yeah, some of the other ones, interesting ones would be your pet's cremation, which is another significant component of your carbon footprint. And, you know, so it uses, in Australia, we use a lot of natural gas to cremate pets, but there are, you know, on further investigation, alternatives to that. So there's aquamation. Yeah. And also I've heard of terramation, apparently, which is kind of like a composting process. So I guess it sort of highlights a little bit that once you start to examine the systems and processes in your practice and you connect suppliers and stakeholders and the whole supply chain, you can start to find that there's actually other solutions to a lot of these things. So it doesn't mean that the pet cremation company are going to go out of business. They just got to find a different way of going about it, really. So, and with our support.
Yeah, I imagine there is also a list of things similar to your, you know, the different classes, those three sort of classes of impacts that we're having. There's also going to be different classes of activities that we do where, for example, we're still going to need to dispose of bodies. We're still going to need to travel places, but the fundamental nature of some of the things that we do is going to have to change. Like, we don't need to drive super fast cars around tracks. And so things like that are going to be in a different, you know, there's going to be nice to haves and need to haves. And some of those things are going to end up changing dramatically or stopping, and other things are going to appear and replace them. What is the, I'm going to back up one second there and go, you know, for me, and I look at the world, you know, this to me is a no-brainer, but there are enough people on this planet that seem, whether they're in denial or, and I don't want to, you know, I feel like quite negative about labeling people. You know, we've had so much labeling left and right, Brexit and not Brexit, denialists, you know, these things all feel like unhelpful because they're making assumptions that individuals cannot be, you know, that we exist in this binary state of one thing or another. I suspect that's an unhelpful label. However, there are significant numbers of people who vote for parties that are, by their very nature, the word conservative, you know, they want things to remain a certain way, a comfortable life. We got very used to driving our gas-guzzling cars. We know gaseous anesthesia. It seems less scary than other things. I mean, heck, I woke up this morning fully intent on cycling to the swimming pool, which is a heated swimming pool and probably heated by gas. And the weather, because I live in the United Kingdom and it's February, it was foul and it was raining. And I thought, you know what? I'm just going to drive there because it was easier and it was more convenient. And I thought, God, I'm interviewing Jeremy about this subject. And well, that's a really bad start to the day, isn't it? But that's the big challenge, isn't it? So there's two hurdles in terms of getting your message across. There's the understanding the why and then internalizing it to the action of behavior change. And I wonder if we could just touch on, okay, let's talk about the why, because there are people who are in a stage of denial or feel strongly that this is not happening, this is not true, that climate change is just a cyclical thing and it's not real. So I'd like to address that or have you speak to that. And then I wonder if we can talk about, and it might be we get into the study first and then we talk about actionable strategies as we move on from the paper discussion. But let's start with, let's just address, is this real? Do we have to be, and I'm asking this as a person who does believe it's real, but I'm asking for the people who don't. Is it real? Give us the TED Talk on the evidence.
Yeah, look, and there's a whole lot to dive into there. And, you know, I guess as scientists, we've got the training to understand, you know, where it's at with climate science. And there's a couple of studies that sort of really swung it for me to make it absolutely clear that this is a big change from the last million years. And on the Vets for Climate Action website, we have some excellent webinars by Professor Mark Howden. He's an Australian professor of climate science. He sits on chairs one of the IPCC committees and is a Nobel Prize winner. And he's also on the board of Vets for Climate Action. He's done some excellent webinars on climate science, where it's at, and sort of making it kind of accessible and slanting it to how it's going to impact on animal health. But there's a really good study in 2008 looking at the levels of carbon dioxide collected from gas bubbles out of ice core samples over the last 800,000 years. And so in that time, the gas levels, carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere go from about 100 to 300, and they go up and down about 8 times. And when they go down, we have an ice age. And when they go up, it's warm. And it never in the last 800,000 years has it gone above 300 parts per million. Today, and this is only in the last 200 years that it started to go up, we're now at 420. So we haven't even had time for that to sink in on this geological scale, because normally there's 100,000 years between the peak and a trough. There's probably, I think Mark said, about 6 degrees between the top and the bottom of these troughs. And now we've shot way, way over the top of anything that we've seen. So, you know, from that, you could say, wow, this is a really radical change from the past. And from this graph, when it goes up, the climate gets warmer. So that's kind of the inference. I know climate science is a lot more complicated than that, but, you know, it's pretty compelling piece of evidence there to say, well, okay, this is a problem. And then you ask me about the sort of the next thing as well, how do you get people change and what kind of emotions are involved? And one of the things that I found very hard to understand was the kind of varied emotional responses we get when you start talking about climate change. And why is it so awkward to have a discussion with some people about this? And why do you don't want to go there? And there's an excellent book by Australian researcher, social researcher Rebecca Huntley, How to Talk About Climate Change in a Way That Makes a Difference. And that kind of crystallized everything for me, because she's a sociologist, she's a journalist, so she writes really well, and she talks about the different emotional responses to climate change. So fear and anger and love, loss, that sort of things. And then sort of tries to say, well, which of those emotions can we use, or which are the most potent to create lasting change? So things like fear and anger are very kind of short-term strong emotions, and people get very angry and want to do something, and then, you know, a couple of months later it's all kind of dribbled away and that's it. And so she sort of talks about hope and particularly love. Now, when she means love, she means so love of your favorite holiday destination, which is going to be impacted by climate change, or love of your grandchildren, particularly for a lot of those older generation who are struggling with this concept, or love of your pet, which is where, you know, we as vets come into it and say, well, you know, we're doing this because it's in the best interest of your pet and you love your pet, kind of thing. So they're trying to join those dots as well. But she does an annual kind of pulse of where the attitudes are within the community. And, you know, if I sort of really simplify it, you know, you've got sort of, say, 20% on the one side of the bell curve who are committed, doing as much as they can, they get it. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got a group of people, maybe another 10 or 20% who, for a whole lot of reasons, are completely ignoring it, denying it, don't want to have a bar of it. And, you know, when you sort of delve into it, they're not necessarily rational reasons, but they're valid reasons for them and for their belief set. And so I guess the real opportunity is that big chunk in the middle who know it's a problem, know we should be doing something about it, but are just a bit stuck about, well, what do I do next? How do we get moving on this? How can we make it easy for them to start moving? They're the ones we really want to try and connect with and start them to get to do a bit more.
Part of the problem always feels like we know that if we can restrict climate, our global warming to, and it's only 1.5 degrees, isn't it? If we can just restrict it to that, it will only be really bad. And we're on target to not, you know, we're on course to go past that. But 2 degrees, 2.5, 3 degrees, there's still, it feels like that's a very small number. That's the difference between a, you know, a, for those who work in Celsius, you know, a 12 and a 14 degree day in winter, or in Australia, you know, a 30 or a 32 degree day in morning in Sydney or something like that. And in the US, that might be a, you know, a 4 Fahrenheit change or something like that, you know. So it's, that in itself, like, oh, well, what's the big deal with that? I don't care if it's 1.5 degrees, but that's, so it feels like that's a number that's often talked about, but it's so easy to write off as, well, mess, so what? What does that number actually mean? What is going past that number? What are the implications of that? And why is it not a 1.5 or a 2 degree change, really?
Yeah, look, it's a really unfortunate metric. You know, it was pity it's not 100 to 1,500 to 2,000 kind of thing, and people would kind of get that it's a big number, but that's the way it's done. Yeah, look, I mean, the implications are huge for, and if you look at the latest IPCC reports, they have a really good summary for policymakers, and in there, particularly if we're going to talk about animal health, there's some really good graphs there which show the difference between 1.5 to 2 to 3 degrees and the loss or displacement of biodiversity, particularly across the tropics. And, you know, it gets up to 100% in a lot of areas once you're getting into 2 and 3 degrees. So that's the biodiversity. But the other thing that is still the kind of big unknown is what they call these tipping points, which is where the Arctic ice starts to melt and won't refreeze. The permafrost starts to melt and release a whole lot of methane that then accelerates the process, and it won't refreeze. And then all of a sudden you've got a whole lot of water released into the ocean, and then we start to get sea level rise. And already they're predicting a minimum of 0.5 meter by the end of the century, but potentially if the whole Antarctic ice cap melts, we're talking 10 meters. So the consequences of these small incremental changes is massive amounts of extra energy in the atmosphere that has to do something, and that's why it turbocharges the weather systems.
Right.
So we get the extreme weather events, and so
okay.
You know, so you might get some extra hot days, yeah, but also then you get these, you know, huge rain dumps to follow. And so, and that's only going to continue.
Right. And we're seeing these massive heat domes and these storms brewing and coming in much more frequently, those extremes of things.
The point I want to make about the impact on animal health, and there's an excellent book, Climate Change and Animal Health, by Stephen and Duncan. Definitely worth having a look at that. And in that book, they talk about the economic resources available for animals to respond and adapt. And so if we look at the three groups of animals, the domestic animal, the pets, and then you've got livestock, and then you've got wildlife. And so a lot of pets, particularly in modern Western economies, are shielded by the resources of their owner. And so in my practice, we get a heat wave and they say, well, how are you going with your bulldog? And I say, yeah, no worries, we just leave them at home with the air conditioner on. No problem. So if they've got the resource, that's great. Too bad for those that don't have that resources. They have to suffer. And then you've got livestock. Well, they can, you know, they've got economic resources to shift to a different region, adapt their production processes, et cetera, et cetera. But then when you get to wildlife, there's really only government and philanthropy who are going to provide economic resources to try and help them cope with the adaptation strategies. And so that's where I think where the, most of the devastation is going to occur.
You mentioned something quite chilling there, you know, 100% loss of, you know, biodiversity in certain areas of the planet or being uninhabitable. Of course, nothing exists in isolation on our planet. Everything is connected, and ice caps melting will have changes. I assume that's a lot of fresh water that's going to melt and be dumped into the sea and change salinity, and that's going to have implications for marine environments. I don't know what that does to currents and whatnot. Loss of biodiversity in every area affects through rainfall cycles and through food change. You know, there's no part of the planet wouldn't be affected by not, I mean, the butterfly effect is really under-egging it. You know, this is This is not a butterfly wing beat. This is complete interconnectedness, and this is why it's catastrophic change. Is that not the case?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Look, 1.5 degrees in reality, you know, if you look, there's a website called Climate Action Tracker, and they track the where we're headed with current policies in action. And so with the current policies and actions that are being implemented, not the ones that have been promised, but the ones that are being implemented, we're headed to 2.5 to 3 degrees of warming on current trajectory. So there's a lot of work to be done. And this, we talk a lot about 1.5 degrees, but, you know, it's getting harder and harder and harder to see that we're going to get anywhere near that on current. And so you can go to the climate clock on the internet, and that tells you how many days left before we've exhausted the budget to 1.5 degrees. It's about 5 or 6 years now, I think 6 years. And then once we've done that, we've filled up our budget for that, and it's on to the next.
Okay. And that is not a glib exercise in just resetting a clock. That is abandoning parts of the planet and populations of people and animals who live in that those bits of the world.
Mm. Yep.
Okay, that's all. That's not just sobering. I would suggest that is terrifying. And existentially, that is also part of the problem. Is it's so big that it's just easier just if we just ignore it. Like, we think in such short-term cycles. Like, how do we get people out of short-termism and just the, you know, it's, we're talking about the changes that need to happen need to be moment to moment. And I'm feeling increasingly more and more guilty about not cycling to the pool right now and not actually just going to swim and freeze in the sea rather than going to the pool.
You'd be a lot more invigorated.
Yeah. And I'm just glad we're doing this over a video link, not actually in person, having flown to Australia or something like that. But that is the nature of this. That is, it requires us to make myriad micro changes in our behaviors in our day-to-day en masse. And it's those myriad micro changes that change things. It's not governments. The government cycles. And, you know, governments putting this on us is going to be part of the issue, but they seem to drag their feet so far, and we seem mired in governments that are completely inept. And this is not, it's not on the radar of any of Rishi Sunak in the UK's big highlight agenda promises. Anything that the Labour Party promised has been watered down already pre-government. It certainly wasn't on the Australian government before it changed over to the Labour. I don't know what the situation is now. And God forbid we have another Donald Trump presidency. And then we're not, then we're talking about a world that is on, feels like it's on the brink of war, left, right, and centre at the minute. And with increasing resource scarcity, which is likely to be the outcome of us not accomplishing this goal, it's bloody depressing. So, and all of that just leads people to go, well, what's the point in the little changes? So, Jerry, I want to get into the report because that's why I wanted you on the show, because what you've gotten in this report is an actionable pathway and you're living, breathing evidence of it isn't all out with our control. If every single one of us takes responsibility for the minutiae in our day, then we do stand a chance, regardless of what governments prattle around at the edges with. So I would love to segue across into your report, but I just wonder before we do that, you know, I've painted a pretty depressing picture there. Where do you sit on the sort of scale of optimism or otherwise, or are there any comments on what I just said?
Yeah, look, I mean, all of what you said is spot on, but, you know, in the end, you know, we have to have hope. Without it, you know, you lose your purpose. And I guess the issues, you know, it's not that humanity hasn't faced, you know, major crisis before. You know, we've had the threat of nuclear war, we've had pandemics, we've got the threat, impending threat of AI. So these, you know, all these issues are there. And I think, and certainly climate change is a variant of that kind of thing. And so, you know, I guess if you worry about these too much, you know, it ultimately can do your head in. And so somehow, you know, I compartmentalize these things and then start worrying about the things that you can change. You know, you're far better off to do your worrying about something that you can have influence over. And so in my situation, that's influence in my veterinary sphere. And so that's where I'm putting my energies. And while I'm aware of what the politicians are doing, I don't get too invested in that. They're going to come and go. The climate change problem is going to continue to march on. And the strategy that we're developing will transcend the political cycles. And that's the best I can do. And I feel like that, you know, maybe in 10, 20 years, I look back and say, well, you know, I gave them the best shot. But ultimately, you know, we live, and there was a quote from a journalist, we live, you know, day to day, week to week, month to month, and the whole climate crisis kind of rumbles along. I think her quote was like a knot in your stomach was her comment, but I'm perhaps not quite that bad, but it's there. And so I think that you need to develop your own, you know, perpetual action plan and keep working on the things that you can work on, influencing those around you. And hopefully what we're looking at the Vets for Climate Action is to do what's called base building, which is where we're trying to connect, use the actions of the veterinarians to connect with the wider population, of which 60% own pets. Hey, if the vet's doing it, maybe I should get on board. And then ultimately the politicians to say, oh, there's widespread support for this. We'll get better policies, because if we can, policies are the most powerful tool to change, but you've got to have support. And the politicians are able to exploit it if people don't understand it or just not that interested. They've got bigger issues at the moment. Their day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month issues transcend the slow burn, or which is becoming a slow, not a slow burn, but you know, the ongoing threat that climate change will present.
Almost no pun intended. It was a slow burn as well. I instantly feel better by what you said, though, because it's empowering. And that phrase, hope and love, is burned bright in my mind right now. So let's offer our listeners some hope, shall we, Jeremy? And we're going to put, you are, I have to say, you're a master at throwing out great resources. And I'm making a list of the resources you're mentioning. We're going to link up all of these in the show notes for everybody, that you can dig into this. And thousands of people listen to this podcast. So guys, I'm really going to encourage you to not listen to one show and be done with this, but to get deeper into this, not to become an expert, not to win arguments, but to be a leader in making change happen through the micro actions you can undertake in your clinics every day. So let's get into that. Let's talk about the path to net zero in veterinary practices. And so what we're not able to do in a podcast is to share a graphic, but figure one of your report, which is found, so it's published on Frontiers in Veterinary Science. The title of the report is The Path to Net Zero Carbon Emissions for Veterinary Practice. We will have a link to it in our show notes. Don't stop listening and go download it right away, because we're going to do a little bit of walking through it. But there's a figure in there, and it's a really nice outline of how we get to that in a sort of cycle. And I think we've probably covered a lot in part one, understanding why net carbon zero must be accomplished. So the next step on the pathway, and this is a sort of collaborate and advocate cycle. I don't know if you have a better name for it, but continuous collaboration, evaluation, and improvement has certain steps along the way. I'm going to just read them out just now. And then, Jeremy, I wonder if you can take us through there. And there's a couple of things from my own interests I'm really keen to explore a wee bit on as well. So assuming we understand why we've got to move, and that's the motivating purpose that will drive us, i.e. saving our planet and being able to continue human existence, and not just human, but existence of all the brilliant and amazing creatures on this planet. Step one is then, okay, in our practices, aligning business culture and our strategy. Step two is then setting some targets, what do we want to accomplish? Step three, measuring our carbon footprint, which sounds a lot more complicated than you might think. Step four, reporting on that. Step five, it looks like then doing the work of reducing the emissions. And either, great, you've accomplished it, or taking stock and spinning back through this cycle. So it's sort of almost a Kaizen-esque sort of feeling of improving and just working our way towards a point of net carbon zero. But we're all moving in the right direction if we're working on these things. And if I'm not mistaken, this is one of the things that really jumped out at me. I remember when the IPCC first published in, it was in New Scientist that they first, I think, really broke their first report. And this was maybe 2005 or 2006 maybe. And I remember, actually, it might even be four. And I remember just reading that article and feeling massively depressed about where we were. But also then they gave some really good, I went to a presentation on how business could work on reducing a lot of stuff. And I remember going in all full of this and my practice manager just giving me a slap and telling me to get back in my box and stop ruffling feathers. So that was not alignment of business culture and strategy there, Jeremy. So talk us through this cycle. Let's start with the alignment of business culture and strategy. And especially when most practices don't have alignment of their business culture or a strategy beyond eat, sleep, vet, med, repeat. That's a lofty one to kick off with. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, okay. So look, just before I launch into that, I would like to acknowledge the co-authors of this paper, because it was absolutely a collaboration, and I couldn't have done it, or we couldn't have done it. So Karina Klupek, Jane Binloss, who I think you know, and Marianne Marin, who is actually the graphic genius that put this cycle together. Yeah, I really want to acknowledge their contribution to this. So yeah, look, the pathway was drawn from a course I did in Cambridge University on net zero for business, which was really aimed at corporates, but you know, can be applied in any small business situation. And really, the key step in all of those is really that alignment of business and culture. So you've got to have management buy-in to set this process up and drive it. And if they don't, you know, if you've got a motivated individual within a practice, but the management don't get it or are interested, then like your experience, then you go nowhere. So, and that's what the paper is really targeted at, because they're the people that make the decisions, allocate the funds, set the vision and direction of the practice. And so when we sort of talk about, you know, align, so assuming that the practice has decided, yeah, we need to do something about this, you know, align it with your budgets, your standards of care, your recruitment, your marketing. So a net zero strategy impacts on all of those. And so, you know, an example of how it might come undone would be, okay, so the team gets pumped up about recycling, but if management hasn't got a budget for buying some color-coded bins to make it easy, they get despondent. You know, you expect the team to, right, we're going to have low-flow anesthesia, turn the flow rates down, but if they haven't got the proper monitoring capnography and that sort of thing, then it's just compromising your standards of care. So you've got a mismatch there. So it impacts on all components of your business. And I guess the sort of, you know, one of the other things we're trying to to press in this paper is that there's opportunities here. Okay, so it's not all downside, and we want to exploit those opportunities, identify the risks, and mitigate them in this continuous cycle. So, I think, if you look at the whole issue of climate change, business likes certainty, and there's one thing that's absolutely certain, that this will continue to get worse. So why not start having a look at it and finding out where you can find opportunities and how you're going to deal with the risks that are going to be presented to you. So step one.
Okay. And I'll come to this question maybe a bit later, but I'm going to ask it and just park it, and I made a note to come back to it. And I'm just curious, as you were talking, I was just thinking about one of the specific reference to anesthesia. Your people freak out about new anesthetic protocols because everyone's terrified of losing patients. And low flow is an area that particularly freaks people out, because if they've just been used to cranking stuff onto 2 liters and 2%, which is a lot of the way anesthetics are run, and they're not aware of how effectively wasteful and impactful on the animal that is, and then it's hard to get change to happen. Are you kind of then collaborating? One of my other blunt dissection guests, the fantastic Dr. Sheila Robertson, who's an anesthesiologist amongst other things. And when we went through a little period of not being able to get isoflurane in the UK, and we had her come in and do some virtual training with the team and consulting with our nurses, our veterinary nurses, on how to perform, how to use other modalities of anesthesia, which was fantastic. The skill level just went up, and suddenly everyone was like, oh, they were completely buzzed about doing all the things that didn't, low flow anesthesia and total intravenous anesthesia were suddenly, I think we did that for 2 or 3 months in the clinic before we could get decent stock back in. So are you collaborating with people who could offer training resources to practices on areas that might be sticking points to overcome these on the, that's a curious question about the Vets for Climate Action website. Do you have people you can refer people to that are really good at doing these trainings?
Yeah, look, it kind of highlights, the whole anesthesia is just one thing that we're going to have to deal with in your carbon emissions.
Right.
But we would use that as a model to develop a pathway. And this is what is used in other, in the corporate sector, is to line up all your stakeholders from the manufacturer, distributors, equipment makers, the end user, and the disposal, and try and build some collaboration between all of them, because, your supplier is going to think, oh, no one's going to buy all these anesthetic machines that I've bought. That's where it's all headed. And then the manufacturer will be saying, well, I've been making this stuff and won't be able to sell it. So you've got all this sort of fear, anxiety, whatever. And then the end user is feeling like they're having to bear all the brunt of this whole problem. So first thing is to get the stakeholders together. And so who's going to do that? Well, your leadership organizations and Vets for Climate Action have already started getting some anaesthetists, the College of Anaesthetists, together with the big manufacturer of intravenous anesthesia, because they can see an opportunity. And if we're going to move over to intravenous anesthesia, they're going to sell more stuff. So they're keen to get on board and provide training resources. So there's some interesting collaborations that I think can evolve from that process. And then if that's a model, then we're going to start to say, well, okay, we can use this model for cremation. And then the big challenge, the most difficult area to deal with, is going to be some of these scope 3 emissions. So your medical consumables, your drapes, and all. How are we going to find a zero carbon alternative then? I don't know, but I know how the process that needs to be set up to try and find solutions is, and that's these stakeholder collaborations, which can be local, national, international. I think that's, one of the other sort of things that came out of the paper is that's a model for trying to solve difficult problems.
Okay. So there's layers even to the aligning business. There's aligning there's work for all of the stakeholders at all of the levels of veterinary medicine to do, whether it's a group like yourself or that can influence then national organizations like the AVA, the BVA, the AVMA, to have conversations and have broader conversations with people across supply chains, but also to influence through government as well.
Absolutely.
The change. So there's alignment of business or in professional sector culture and strategy, and then there's alignment of individual businesses within that. And that will allow us to be more effective in choosing certain routes because we'll have less pushback from other stakeholders in our supply chain. Okay, so I'm getting that. then we move on to the next step, then setting targets. Now, my sort of sporting brain is at odds here with my, you know, case in incremental change brain here. And you know, what do you recommend for setting targets? I mean, first of all, I suppose, expand upon that in the context of the report. And then my Dave brain is going, okay, do you go big, hairy, audacious here? Or do you go, okay, no, let's do something accomplishable to get some momentum happening here. Talk more about the set targets part of this journey.
Yeah, so, I mean, the ultimate target, you know, which has been put out by all the political parties in Australia, for example, and generally globally, is net zero by 2050. So that's your long-term target. Now, obviously, we don't have to rush there right now. It would be good if we did. And so if you're going to set a target, there's and want to be more be scientific about it, there's the Science-Based Target Initiative, which is an international organisation that is kind of like the reference organisation for this. And they generally recommend a midterm, a 5 to 10 year target, and then a net zero by 2050 as being the two steps. But you need to have a midterm target. Where does that sit in a veterinary practice that's just starting with this? I think the idea is to understand your footprint and set a target to reduce. Now, it might only be a few percent in the first year, but you kind of wrap your head around the processes. You identify where it's coming from. You've made some changes and you can say, well, we're better than we were last year. Okay, step one. And then you might start to say, well, I might set a 2030 target. And then, and which is what you have to do for the registration with Climate Active in Australia. So there's this sort of 5 to 10 year target, and you start to see governments now talk about the 2035 target when they've been talking about the 2030 target for a long time, because as we get closer to 2030, it's not a 5 to 10 year target anymore. So that you need that midterm target and the long-term target, but really it's the annual year-on-year reductions is the first step, really.
Are you seeing a difference in the engagement with this? And it's not long since you published it, and I know that that certainly speaking with you and Jane before, there was a frustration at the sort of feeling of a lack of engagement with the subject and getting access to platform. Obviously, one of the big changes that's driven, been sweeping through the veterinary profession in the last 10, 15 years has been the advancement, the corporatization, the ownership structures of medicine. And that strikes me as being potentially a big opportunity, because you can influence change across a very wide group of clinics by speaking with a smaller group of stakeholders at the top and getting influence there. But obviously, it doesn't strike me as it's something that's high on the agenda of private equity, which is, you know, you're talking about setting 5 to 10 year targets for emissions. You know, we in the United Kingdom have, you know, probably 65-70% of practices in ownership of organizations that have a life cycle, planning life cycle that is shorter than 5 to 10 years before they're going to get flipped on to the next. And that's a problem if this is not on their agenda list of things to tackle. You know, the US is sweeping through. Australia has sort of had more of a stoppy-starty relationship with this, but certainly it sounds like there might be movement happening in the Australian market where consolidation is about to get going again. How do you see the sort of the conversation, is it more or less frustrating for you, or more of an opportunity or a concern for you to engage with corporate entities or larger group corporate entities versus smaller independent entities?
Yeah, look, I think we want to develop the program with the smaller entities and kind of get a reputation for it. And then the thing about the corporate entities, and full disclosure here, my practice has just been sold to a corporate entity. So,
yeah, and my question wasn't a leading question to invoke judgment on any group either, just to be clear. No,
the corporate entities are subject to corporate reporting standards for carbon emissions. So, and that's down to, I think, 200 employees in Australia over the next couple of years. I think I'd have to check that. So it's coming. So they need to start measuring their footprint and reporting their climate risks, particularly if they're listed. So, you know, if you talk about your climate risks, you've got your direct physical risks, you've got your transitional risks, so redundant assets, isoflurane vaporizer would be one in our profession, and then you've got your litigation risks, which really relate to failure to disclose your financial risks with climate. So, but the corporates, you know, I think that if it's part of your culture and that's what you're doing, then if you're wanting to attract you know, Gen Zs and millennials, they're looking for, you know, there's studies from Deloitte. They study 23,000 Gen Zs and millennials each year and look at what are their intentions and views of companies and what do they look for. And like about 60 or 70% are looking for a company that has values aligned with dealing with climate change. So you've got a whole younger generation get that this is a problem they're going to have to deal with, and they want to look for a company that's got that as part of their culture. And so if you're trying to attract staff in a tough market, then that's something that signals that you're serious about caring for your team, caring for the animals and planet and the whole ecosystem that we live in. And look, our experience was with advertising for a new graduate a couple of years ago. So all you've, you know, you run your eye down the adverts for vets and, you know, we have great equipment, we have fun and you get this and that and yada, yada, yada. And so we did a video through our practice and then we said, you know, we are the only carbon neutral practice in Australia and we differentiated ourselves from everyone else. Well, we had a fantastic graduate come down from Queensland absolutely because she saw that. So that, I want to be part of that culture. So 3 weeks to get a new graduate. So in a tight market. So, you know, it feeds into your recruitment strategy, for example.
Right.
And, you know, and they talk about, you know, the mental health issues in the profession as well. And so, you know, if you're throwing in climate anxiety, say, right, well, I'm going to go with a practice that's going to try and do something. So at least I can feel like we can shift the dial and ultimately try and influence our clients that this is an issue and ultimately support the politicians, which is kind of like the dots we're trying to join.
Yeah, revolutions are, not to my knowledge anyway, started by the old. They're started by the young. And they're started for very, very big culturally important reasons frequently, yeah. All of which this has the makings of. Okay, all right, not to deflect down onto that. So, but, you know, and I think, and again, for anyone listening to this, you know, the change makers will come from within organizations, and for the next generations of veterinarians coming through, there is so much focus on ourselves and our well-being and getting a handle on being in veterinary medicine and staying in veterinary medicine. But there's so much economic and good reason to do these things. Like that was one of the things I was struck with by the early information the IPCC were putting out was there is a really strong business imperative to act in these ways as well. Like it's not like there's a trade-off between, I mean, unless you're an oil company, I get that. But for the rest of us, saving money on energy, particularly as oil prices, gas prices, as they become more scarce or we fight over them more, we've seen the effects on those prices and global market shares from war. Whereas sun, I mean, particularly if you live in Australia, not so much in Scotland, is freely available. Hydro is something that will keep coming, is freely available. And of course, there's supply and demand issues, and that's, you know, I'm simplifying there, but there are compelling economic reasons to do these things. And the most compelling one is if you can attract staff because your work, your actions on the ground are aligned with the values and the beliefs and the needs of the people that work in your organization, then that is a hugely important reason to act. And let me tell you, there's fewer more existential crises facing veterinary medicine than not having enough bodies on the ground to actually do the work. And that's, if I were sitting in a corporate headquarters right now in a boardroom, that is something that would be concerning me greatly. So although I see the work you're doing focused at independent level, because that's a group of stakeholders you can influence and start building this reputation with, I really hope, and I know that there are people in corporate boardrooms listen to this show as well that can dig into this and read this report and make change happen as well, because there is just a compelling financial argument to do this as well. Right, off my soapbox, on to measuring the carbon footprint. That feels complicated.
Yeah, so look, and as I said earlier, I might have mentioned earlier, the three components, your scope one, scope two, scope three, and the, you know, the scope one and scope two, which are the things you have direct control over, are easy to measure and relatively easy to convert to a carbon value. But, you know, you can even just measure them and aim for a year-on-year reduction. So you can measure the bottles of isoflurane, the numbers of kilowatt hours, the amount of natural gas that you bought, and then measure the next year and aim for a year-on-year reduction. So that's your scope one and two. It's an easy start. You don't have to get too involved. But if you wanted, and ultimately we're going to have to get to net zero, then we're going to need to understand the whole footprint of the practice And so that means measuring scope three. And there's problems there because we don't, and this is, you know, you talked earlier about what are some of the surprises out of the audit. One of the surprises is that we don't have carbon values for a whole lot of purchases within the practice. I thought they'd have numbers for everything, but they only have a carbon value for sort of commonly used things like a ream of paper or a liter of petrol or a kilowatt hour of electricity. But when you get down to a catheter and a needle and a swab, there's no value for that. Mm-hmm. And so the internationally accepted way to measure that is to do what's called input-output economic analysis. And basically, they look at the dollar spend of, say, the medical field and how much its total carbon footprint is. And so, say, every dollar spent in the medical field would be this much carbon. So we'll kind of tweak that for the veterinary sphere and say, well, you spent $100,000 on consumables, therefore we'll give that a certain carbon value. And in actual fact, that's the biggest component of our carbon footprint, which is somewhat could be, you know, a skeptic might come and say, well, you've just made up these numbers for that. Why should I, you know, buy carbon credits to cover this when we don't even know it's accurate? And I suppose the long-term solution to that is to get the manufacturers to do the carbon audit on their product and ultimately provide you with a zero carbon product. And so you just put zero in your carbon audit. But, you know, the measure of your total footprint is quite a little bit more complicated. It's tedious. You know, it's a bit like bookkeeping. It's better off if you get someone else to do that. So we'd recommend that you probably look at getting a consultant if you want to do a really comprehensive, proper, because you've got to look at boundaries, for example. So, you know, things like a can of pet food. Okay, so is that in or out? Well, if it's consumed in a practice, it is. But if it's sold to someone who takes home and uses it at home, then it's not part of your footprint. So, and this changes from year to year. So you've got to be upfront about, and that's perhaps coming into reporting. But yeah, anyway, so yeah, there are some complexities, but there's some really simple starts with just start reducing your scope one and two.
How much does it cost to do that? And is there government support for this to try and move people along? Or is this on the business owner at present? Like, are there grants to measure your carbon footprint?
No, not in Australia. There's no grants to that. Probably $3,000 to $5,000 to get a proper carbon audit done, and then with Climate Active, you are compelled to buy carbon credits and become net zero. That's another discussion in itself about whether or not you should be net zero at this point. If you go back to the setting of targets, the Science Based Targets Initiative, they recommend that you shouldn't buy carbon credits until you've got down to your last 10% of emissions that are hard to abate, hard to remove.
Because it's too easy?
You should really be better off to put your resources into emissions reduction now.
Yeah.
Rather than just buying carbon credits and saying, well, job done, and I'll just continue as business as usual. But there is, you know, compelling reasons for vets to maybe support carbon credits that relate to biodiversity. Because as I said earlier, you know, biodiversity doesn't have much other than philanthropy and government support to try and provide some resources to mitigate against the effects of, to adapt to the effects of climate change. And so if vets want to do something useful with their philanthropic money, then buying biodiversity credits could be a useful way to do that.
Okay. That feels like that's one of the harder parts and requires a bit of commitment, but not a sort of price tag that is outrageous. And I mean, perhaps one of the reasons why, you know, as we're talking, as I was reading the report, I was thinking about B Corporation status and the, you know, I don't know if that's something that is a term that's used much in Australia. It's certainly I think it was a US model. There's certainly, it's a globally applied framework that looks at more than just sustainability from a climate point of view, but there's certainly that's woven into the fabric of it to an extent. When you go to a company that is a B Corporation certified company, you generally are going to pay a bit more. There's a premium for that product. I certainly don't mind paying that premium in brands that I align with because I understand that they're committed to doing things that are good for the future of us all. And these are costs that you talked earlier about alignment of your marketing strategy. If people understand you are a practice that's on this journey, you don't have to necessarily immediately link the fact, but you can, you know, that premium can be offset, you know, in your prices to cover those costs. And I don't think practices should be afraid of doing that sort of thing because sustainability, we have to be profitable. That is a part of being sustainable as well. Have you any thoughts on that, and maybe a particularly a nod to the cost implications of this, or are they offset by the savings implications?
Yeah, look, and that's what been our experience, is that absolutely there are savings to be made out there now by looking at, so, you know, shift, you know, for example, in Australia, solar panels. So we've got all our power. So it's a 5-year payback period. They last 25 years. We get maybe $150,000 of free electricity over the life of the panel. So, you know, it's kind of like a no-brainer. But then, you know, once you start to, you know, review and sort your rubbish a bit better, it's much cheaper to send stuff to recycling than landfill. So we save a bin a week. So it's another $50 a week. We've changed water saving initiatives and on it goes. Our review of anesthesia, we're doing it a whole lot better. We're doing more CRIs, the profit center. We're using less isofluorone, saving money. So, you know, there's whole lots of – so it's absolutely would be a financial benefit. And
okay,
that's part of the motivation for the paper, realizing that, you know, vets have to run a business, and how is this going to affect on profit, team purpose and client value? And it has to tick all those boxes to be compelling argument. And I think that there's enough there to say, well, it will tick those boxes.
Yeah, and I'm not just hearing financial benefits. I'm actually hearing feel-good benefits, skill upskilling, new skill development benefits. All the good stuff for humans feeling good about themselves are being affected in a positive way by this. Okay, so thank you for answering that. Okay, and then now you move into the reporting on this to start with. So you've set targets, you've measured. I was curious about the report before getting into the actions of reduction of the emissions. So, and again, that seems to fall between, you know, into this sort of collaborate and advocate part of this cycle. So what's the benefit of reporting at that point, and what are you reporting?
Yeah, so you think, well, you just report and that's one number. But, you know, if you drill into it a bit, there's different ways you can report and to whom and for why. So the simplest way would be just to report back to the team and say, well, this is what we've done for the year. This is our target. We're a bit closer, hopefully. Or actually, in our case, you know, we went backwards on some things, and that happens. And so you've got to drill into it and find out why, and then go back and set a new strategy.
What things did you go backwards
on? Well, isofluorine. We focused on, and again, this is changing the practice. So our focus the year before last was to get off as much paper as possible. So we implemented a hospital management system, which was on iPads, which everyone thought, yeah, that's a good idea. But, you know, we had to purchase iPads, then the Wi-Fi wasn't up to it. Then, you know, we were used to paper, and so people drifted back to that and said, no. And then, you know, you've got to tap on the iPads. But, you know, the benefits have been that we don't have to store boxes of paper. We had to put a shed in the back to store all these boxes of paper we never look at. Now it's all on the iPad, and it gives us extra functionality. And now the team is used to it. They can put in dose rates, calculate dose rates, etc. And I don't need to go into too much detail about the benefits of that. But the other financial benefit we've just discovered as our photocopier has come up for renewal is that you know, we were spending $600 a month, and now we don't need that machine. We need the $300 a month machine, because our printing needs have halved. So, you know, there's a financial saving there, as well as a sustainability benefit, as well as a team benefit. And we wouldn't have probably rushed into doing that if we weren't sort of focused on saying, well, let's get rid of that. But while we're doing that, the practice grew, and we didn't really do much about isofluorine other than try and turn the flow rates down. But this year we've had a much more renewed focus, and we're changing our pre-meds and doing more intravenous and nerve blocks, et cetera, which is really making significant inroads into our isofluorine reduction. So it made us come back and say, righto, that's our next challenge, because a lot of change going on and a lot of change for the team. And particularly with anaesthetic, where patient safety is at risk, you've got to be careful about how you go about it, make sure everyone's on board and agrees and understands, and then you try on your low-risk patients, make sure you get it bedded in and then roll it out that way. So so anyway, back to reporting. So reporting to the team, the reporting to somewhere like a public register, like Climate Active, is more rigorous in terms of how you break it down and how you've done your calculations, that sort of thing. And then the other thing is you need to report where your boundaries were. So this might be more important for a corporate, you know, where the ownership structures might be different. And so who's controlling that, who owns it, which practices are we talking international, are we talking local? So there's the physical boundaries, and then also that there's the things that you may or may not have included in the report. So, for example, a lot of corporations will just do scope one and scope two. So they'll report that and say, well, we've done our carbon footprint, but they haven't. They've made a start, and they need to be very clear that they've only done scope one and two, and then ultimately scope three will be the entire carbon footprint. So there's different ways of reporting, and the methodologies do sometimes change as new information comes to hand. So they might tweak the emissions factors a little bit. So they're not always set in stone, but they're sort of roughly about, you know, where it's agreed that they should be. So yeah, it's a whole sort of science in itself, I suppose. And there is the greenhouse gas protocol, which is really the foundation document for all of this, which outlines your measuring, reporting and boundaries and all that sort of thing.
I'm sort of hearing that this is a stage which is really about just taking stock and thinking about what you're going to report on, what are the factors that you're going to, you think you can accomplish meaningful progress on in a year and be accountable to. And it is an accountability moment. I'm curious off the back of that thought then, you know, do you have, I'm thinking from my practice, I have a dashboard of things I look at, which are just the really key big numbers that if they're okay, I always describe it as being like the urine test for the practice. You know, there's a lot that has to go right for the urine test to be normal. And it doesn't really tell you a lot about exactly why things are going wrong if it's weird, but it's an indicator you need to have a look under the hood and do some more testing and digging. Do you have a sort of dashboard, you know, because it sounds like with this, it's complicated. There's a lot of things you could measure. Do you have some bigger picture measures of, you know, I'm thinking, for example, for culture, I would look at your team net promoter score. Is there a climate change dashboard equivalent of that, that you say, well, look, this number's pretty good at the minute, or you mean to work a bit on there? Or is that just not a helpful concept?
Yeah, look, I think the short answer is no, not really at the moment. We're still kind of wrapping our head around the process. Where do you park the data so you can access it easily? Obviously, yeah. We have the end of year reporting. And so one of the things that in the Better Climate Action, the Climate Care Program is trying to develop, say, that October will become Sustainability Month. So we have Dental Month in, say, August, October. So that's when you've done most of your audit, your report comes through, you have some sustainability initiatives with your clients and team, and that's when you sit down, take stock and reset for the year. There's little moments like with our isoflurane monitoring, we're going to monitor that every 3 months and report back to the team and say, well, we've done these changes, because I think if you do it much shorter than that, there's sort of variations in your workflow that might impact that such that it sort of distorts the data a bit. Maybe you could do it every 2 months perhaps, but we're trying 3 months. We'll see how that works. Maybe we'll change that. So still feeling our way with this whole process a little bit.
Absolutely. Okay, and then that moves into the final step in this cycle, and that is the actions that will reduce emissions. And here we could talk a lot, and we've touched on some of the things. So maybe are there things in particular you would want to mention there as the, you know, I think the lowest hanging fruit we've spoken about so far have been things like working on those scope one things of what you're specifically consuming in the practice, a la anesthetics, scope two, who you're buying your energy from, and make, being purposeful or intentional in your choices there. But for the listeners, could you highlight anything you think is really important there? Glibly, I want to ask you for like, give us a top three or a top five or something to work on there, but I don't want to steer it to be glib, so you can, you know, say whatever you feel like saying there.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the absolute simplest thing that you can do that would make a huge difference is to sign up to well, in Australia, we call it a green power agreement. So 100% of your power is from renewables. So that line item goes from maybe 60 tonnes in the practice to zero straight away. So that's an easy thing. Nice. Maybe there's a small margin you'd have to pay, but that's an obvious one. The thing about scope one and two is you can easily measure and you have direct control. So they're the low-hanging fruit. Your practice vehicles, there's zero carbon alternatives for all of this now. As you've found when you couldn't get isoflurane, you still anaesthetise patients. So it's there. So there's solutions for all of that. And most of them, particularly with things like changing your hot water and air conditioning to heat pump technology, is more efficient, more energy efficient, and gives a better outcome as well. So there, that's the obvious ones. And then, you're starting to get into the more difficult ones, and that's where it's going to be the challenge for us. Once we get our isoflurane down, that's most of our scope 1 and 2 sorted, and it's going to be difficult. And so that's where the collaboration, trying to build these collaboration networks and the broader thing will be the way forward, I think.
Okay. And that kind of takes us around the cycle. That then brings us back up to the start point, which was, when you get around it a second time, is then realigning or reviewing how well you've accomplished this and what else needs to change within your business, within your culture, within your strategy in order to keep moving through. It's a really useful framework, and I'm so pleased. Like, when we spoke initially and you were working on getting this sort of finalized, I was excited to hear about it. And I feel more excited having had this conversation with you, and I'm already itching to get this sent off to my team and my practice and look at my own personal usage things as well. And that's the sort of impact that conversations like this, I think, have. A couple of final questions then, and if there's things we've not covered that you think are really important that we say on this conversation, then I'll give you the chance to say that. But I'm just curious, what you mentioned, you've sold your clinic. How do you feel now, and what was the impact of that conversation on your buyers about you being a net zero practice? Did you get the sense, and I'm asking you an unfair question because I'm asking you to speak to something maybe you're not comfortable to speak to, or you don't have an opinion on, or wouldn't reflect well on them. So I'm not going to ask you to, don't say anything you're uncomfortable to say here. But what was their response to that? How did they engage with that? And how do you feel like, do you have concerns that falls by the wayside? You know, a lot of stuff that you do as an owner, somebody buys your clinic and then, you know, you just see them gradually changing everything you did, and you feel a bit sad about what used to be. How do you feel? What are your thoughts on that?
So far, they've been fantastic, actually. They've been genuinely impressed. And part of the deal was that if we were to sell it, we have to continue our carbon neutral status, and they're fine with that.
They're going to suck you up to the board and have you being the advocate for this across their group?
Yeah, that's a conversation that's evolving. But
come on.
The corporates understand that this is it's going to be forced on them, or they're going to be playing catch up with everyone else. And it's interesting if you have a look at the Mars veterinary website in the US. So Mars, they've got 3,000 clinics. They're really moving rapidly into the whole sustainability space, and their website is, you know, people, pets, planet. And then they've got a 100% green power purchase agreements, but then they're also moving into other sustainability initiatives. So they kind of get it. You know, we're in the care industry. I mean, there's so many, you know, connections that can be made there. It really aligns with all of that, and it's good for business, you know. So, you know, there's no reason why not to get started.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that's also always stands out about Mars is that they have a 50-year business plan, and that is very different to groups that are holding for 4 or 5 years to play the arbitrage game to sell on. It's the bigger entities that are going to be the long-term holders and stakeholders in the future of veterinary medicine that are the ones that stand to benefit and are more likely to engage with this beyond anything that is cosmetic, let's say. And certainly, you know, I know the likes of Molly McAllister, you know, riding a high wave up at the top of the ecosystem in Mars. This is the sort of thing that is right up her boulevard. And I hope that, you know, former guest on the show and will also, you know, be listening to this and hopefully having influential conversations or ongoing conversations. That is nice to hear. There's lots of takeaways. This is going to be one of those episodes where I think a lot afterwards, for sure. My three things I've written down here are hope and love. I just think that, you know, there's so much fear and negativity in the media, and it can really weigh and get you down. But hope for a better future and love to motivate you. Hope can be a terrible thing, you know. It's the hope that gets you, but love will drive you far. And it's, you know, it's a love of not necessarily nostalgic love for what was, but a love for what we still have. I think that is such a powerful motivating message in there, which cascades into control what you can, which was a big takeaway for me from what you said. And of course, an action imperative, a first action imperative is, you know, bloody download and read the paper. from the Frontiers website and start to take action. It's not the case to say there's nothing to lose here. There's an awful lot to lose. There's everything to lose. But there is much, much to gain through the actions that, we can take. So, Jeremy, thank you to you and your co-authors, and a shout to my good friend Jane as well for doing this work and publishing this. Last words, you know, to you. What needs to be said? What have we not said or covered? What messages would you like to leave the audience with as they depart this conversation and go about their days?
I think you've just got to start to have a look and start to have a look at what's required to become sustainable and carbon neutral, and start to think, well, once I start to have a look, that's when you start to find out that there are all these opportunities and there's a whole lot of stuff that you can do, rather than, you know, as I talked about, that large cohort in the middle who know it's a problem but just don't know where to start. Well, there is a place to start, and it's not that hard, and there's a few things you can do, and you get a taste for it, maybe there's a few more. So that's really about that. And I suppose the other one, you know, if we put one word as to how we're going to solve this, it's really collaboration. You know, it's going to be collaboration on all levels. It's a global problem. It's a local problem. It's a national problem. It's an international problem. And so, you know, we're going to need collaboration on all levels. So that's probably the one word that kind of sums up how we're going to solve this.
All right, Jeremy. And since you're, I hope, rapidly going to become something of the tip of the spear on this, perhaps, where was the one place you'd direct people? Obviously, we are going to put tons of links into the show notes here. But where can people reach out to you, speak to you, contact you, or where would you like to direct people to as a next step, other than their energy provider, to buy a carbon zero energy source?
As in to contact me. I mean, what I'd like to people to do is
be careful here, Jeremy, because if indeed you do wish people to contact you, but you may direct the traffic or the inquiries or the curious nature of the audience that we have on the show. Where would you like to direct them?
Yeah, I think within your own country, there are veterinary sustainability organisations now established and rapidly developing. So UK Vet Sustain, France Ecovito, there's Sustainability Alliance in the UK, Canada, and then Vets for Climate Action in Australia. So that's your first port of call to start collaborating and find out, you know, what are the opportunities in your neighbourhood and who are the people that are doing stuff and are willing to help, because there's no shortage of people within the space willing to help to go to the next step, really. So I think that's probably the go-to place for in the veterinary sphere.
All right. And notable by its absence was a place in the US. Is there anything that you're aware of happening there?
Yeah, I think it's the Sustainability Alliance. So there's some really good stuff come out of Colorado State University. Colleen Duncan there, she's co-authored the book on climate change. She's a driving force. And so they've got that organization up and running. So I think there's one, Pets for Planet, perhaps, I think, maybe. And that's more not veterinary specific, but an animal focused, pet focused climate initiative, really. So, yeah, look, you know, obviously the politics of it in the US has become very toxic, unfortunately. And
yeah,
anyway, look, that's another discussion. I don't know. I don't really want to get too worried about it. It is what it is, and I can't influence that, so I'm not going to worry about it.
You're sticking to your core principle there, which I respect. Okay, fantastic. Jeremy, thank you so much for your time coming on the show. Really enjoyed our conversation, and thank you to you and Karina and Jane and Marianne for producing the report and reviewed by Colleen Duncan at Colorado State. Great piece of work. Well done for getting that over the line. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, look, Dave, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure to be on your show. And yeah, I hope everyone downloads the paper and gets started. We've got a lot of work to do.
Well, you've certainly inspired me.
All right. Yeah, great. Thanks.
So that is a wrap for another episode of Blunt Dissection. Thank you so much for listening. Before you jump off and get on with your life, would you do me a little favor? Or maybe three. Favorite one, would you just do a quick shout out on social media to let people know you enjoyed the show? Favorite two, drop a little review onto iTunes. And favorite three, if you think somebody needs to benefit and hear this show today, please share it with them. The show has helped countless people overcome countless problems over the years we've been doing it. And it's recommendations and shares that allow that magic to happen. So from all of us here at Blunt Dissection Podcast, to all of you out there, until next time, be safe, be well, and be happy.